This is the first day of this April 2010 seven-day session. And we're going to read from the teachings of the Chinese Chan master Da Hui, 12th century Chan master Da Hui. He's notable primarily as the great reviver of the Linqi school, the Rinzai school of Chan or Zen. In that regard, he sort of is the Chinese counterpart of Hakuin. Hakuin is esteemed as a great reformer who brought the koan system back to life in the Rinzai school in Japan. But really, Da Hui is credited with having done the same thing in China. First, some biographical material about him. He was born in the year 1088, just south of the Yangtze River, if that means anything to anyone. In school, he is reported to have shown a preference for the Dharma, or Buddhism, over worldly studies. I'm reading here from a book called Swampland Flowers, The Letters and Lectures of Zen Master Da Hui. And it's translated by Christopher Cleary. This is in the introduction, this short biography of him. Even at an early age, he was considered remarkable throughout the vicinity. When he was 16, he left home. Left home in these old texts, always means he entered a monastery, and then at 17, a year later, he became a monk. He dropped his hair, is the literal translation. Had his head shaved as a monk. Home leaver more generally means a monk. It says he took delight in the doings of the Chan school and read extensively about all of the five lineages, the primary lineages of Zen at the time. And he was especially drawn to the teachings of Yunmen, or Umon in Japanese, and Yunmen's teacher, Mu Zhao. But he had this doubt. Since originally there had been just this one teaching of Bodhidharmas, why were there so many different schools or lineages? It's a question that comes up for many young people. Why are there so many religions anyway? Because there are so many different temperaments. People have different temperaments and different affinities with spiritual teachings. There will always be, as long as there's any religion, there will be multiple religions because different religions appeal to different people. And that can change also over time. People sometimes switch traditions, even religions, as they develop. Some people, it's not common, but some people may come to appreciate other aspects of themselves that emerge and seek a better match. By nature, he was exceptionally talented and not bound by convention. When he was 19, he began his travels through the country, visiting various temples and teachers, seeking instruction from other teachers. or from teachers, period. He was still only 19. And we're told that he, even at this early age, reminded others of previous famous Chan masters. One of the teachers he visited gave him instruction on a certain part of the Blue Cliff record. That's a big famous collection of koans. It says the teacher would not offer a word of explanation, but made Dawi express his own view. Well, of course, that's become standard. Although even that is now being sacrificed, forsaken by a number of teachers. I heard of one a teacher very well known in Europe, who will, when you go in and you present your understanding of the koan, he'll say, "No, this is how you do it," and then he'll just demonstrate it for him. But it said that even though the teacher offered no explanation, in every case, Dawi completely comprehended the subtle meaning. It would be a remarkable thing if for every koan he completely comprehended the subtle meaning. It can't mean that, because according to this account, he hasn't had any kind of awakening yet. So what that must mean is that he had a very, very subtle, fine intellectual understanding, and could talk about it, but that's nothing like really grasping the essence of the koan. The older master, it doesn't give a name, the older master exclaimed, "You must be someone who's come again." That is, someone who has been reborn, who had been a master in a previous life. So then it says here, Dawi understood the message from his long knowledge of the Zen tradition, but he rejected the formalized, ceremonious way that Dharma transmission happened, and said, "If there were transmission in Chan, how could this be the self-realized, self-awakened to Dharma of the patriarchs?" I know what he means. The first time I was offered Dharma transmission in the Soto lineage, this is not from Roshi Kaplow, he gave me his, but then there is this whole Soto school, and a teacher, another Soto teacher in the United States, offered me Dharma transmission in that, and I said, "Thanks, but no thanks. You know, I've never even worked with you as a teacher. Why would I accept Dharma transmission? It's such an empty shell of what does that make transmission?" Just, and then again, the same thing happened later. Another teacher offered to me. I guess their assumption is that because our own pedigree is not all perfectly gift wrapped with a bow on top, because Roshi Kaplow had a break, he parted ways with his teacher Yasutani Roshi before he received full Dharma transmission, that's something that I would want, but I've been around long enough to recognize that there are just way too many teachers who have Dharma transmission who have absolutely no degree of awakening, and it's becoming just too much of a ceremonial thing, a shell, really, a shell without any real substance to it. Thanks, but no thanks. Later, he went to Master Chan Dong. When Dawi first got there, his intellectualism was unrestrained. Well, that tells you right there that he couldn't have had any real realization before going there. His intellectualism was unrestrained. One day, this teacher, Chan Dong, asked, "Why are your nostrils boundless today?" I've never been able to relate to that question. It sounds like Cleary has a tendency to be too literal in his translations, I believe, and so do some other teachers. There's always there's an art to translation where you can go with the literal and not worry about too much about interpreting the original language, such as Chinese, or you can try to go do the hard work of trying to ferret out the real meaning behind the original language. And you can go too far either way. I think that the Cleary brothers tend to be too literal, and so as a result, you get translations like this. Now, this may have some cultural significance in China that I'm not aware of, and that would explain it. But I mean, surely it does have that. But still, in an English language translation, preserve this kind of a rendition, "Why are your nostrils boundless today?" without any kind of cultural explanation of the cultural meaning of it, is, I think, regrettable. But probably no language is more difficult to translate than Chinese, because it's so Chinese and Japanese, because it's so vague, so imprecise. There's no distinction between, in most cases, I'm told, there's no distinction between singular and plural, and it's very spare in the Chinese characters, and you have to fill in a lot. That's why with koans, there can be quite different translations of these koans. Sometimes you wonder if it's the same koan that the translators come up with such different versions of it. Anyway, "Why are your nostrils boundless today?" And Dawi replied, "Because I'm at your place." To which the master said, "You phony Chan man." Again, once when Dawi was reading a sutra, the master asked, "What sutra are you reading?" He said, "The Diamond Sutra." The master said, and this is quoting from the Diamond Sutra, "This Dharma is everywhere equal, without high or low. Why then is Yunchu Mountain high and Pao Feng Mountain low?" That actually has became a koan that some people here work on. Dawi replied, "This Dharma is everywhere equal without high or low." So he just repeats the phrase of the question. And then the master again, you can almost see him holding his nose, he said, "You could be a lecturer's assistant." Sounds like this is just what Dawi needed. When we hear this phrase, unrestrained, let's see, his intellectualism was unrestrained. we can infer from that that he was intellectually arrogant. He's probably very bright, very high IQ, and many such people are pretty conceited. So he needed to get cuffed by this master to take him down a couple notches in order not just to humiliate him, but in order to open him up so that he could receive what the master had to offer. You could be a lecturer's assistant. And then one day the master said to him, "You understood my Chan at once. When I had you explain, you could explain. And when I had you give informal talks or general lectures commenting on the ancients, you could do that too." So in other words, okay, you've got the knowledge, you've got the intellectual understanding of the Dharma. But he says, there's just one thing that's not there. Do you know what? Dawi said, "What?" And the master said, "You only lack this one liberation that is in the burst of power. If you don't get this one liberation, there's Chan while I'm talking with you in private, but as soon as you leave the Doksan room, there's not. There's Chan while you're awake and thinking, but as soon as you fall asleep, there's not. If you're like this, how can you be a match for birth and death?" Dawi replied, "This is precisely my point of doubt." All right, now we're getting somewhere. Now Dawi has owned up to the fact that he's not satisfied with all of his book learning about Zen. And now he's starting to open up and recognize that he has no understanding. He doesn't have the real good. He doesn't have the goods. He doesn't have the real thing. This is precisely my point of doubt. Very promising now, very promising state to be in this state of dissatisfaction. That's where the money is. Dissatisfied, discontented, wondering, needing deeper understanding. Without that, Zen practice is just a relaxation practice. Well, the master, this Chan Dong, fell ill. He was near death, and Dawi asked him, "If you don't recover, whom should I take as a teacher, as my next teacher, so that I can complete this great affair?" And the master referred him to Yuan Wu, one of the more famous of the Chinese masters of that period in Chinese history. Yuan Wu is credited as the author or the editor of the Blue Cliff Record, which is often considered by many to be the single most extraordinary collection of koans. And then the master said, "Though I don't know him myself, you must place your reliance on him and you'll be able to complete your affair. You'll be able to come to understanding. If you see him without completely comprehending, then go on practicing, and in a later life, you'll appear and realize Chan." This seems to be a little different tone in Chinese Zen from Japanese Zen. I can't recall in the English translations of books that I've read I can't recall a Japanese master being as philosophical about that. Well, if you don't get it this time around, then you'll come back and you'll be able to get it next time. But more than a couple of texts of Chinese Zen, Chan, show this, where the master will say this kind of thing. Work hard, and well, if you don't get it in this life, then you'll come back in your next life, and then surely you'll realize your true nature. So Da Wei took his advice, that is his master's advice, and went and found Yuan Wu. And on his way there, he set a time limit for himself. This Da Wei said, all right, he said, I'll give it 9 years. And if this guy's Chan is no different from the other places, and he falsely considers himself right, then I'll write that there is no Chan. Delving into a great sutra or treatise is better than wasting energy and getting bogged down for years. You can see how deficient his understanding, how immature he is by thinking that, becoming a renowned scholar of a sutra, how that is better than just persevering through years and years and years of practice and training. Delving into a great sutra is better than wasting energy and getting bogged down for years. By cultivating the fundamentals, I think by that he means at least by continuing to sit, I'll not slip from being a man of the Buddha Dharma in future lives. So he makes what is not an uncommon mistake by setting a time limit. Every once in a while, someone comes and says, well, how long will it take me to come to awakening? Would you tell me that? And what they're not saying, but what's in their mind is, well, if it's not soon enough, then I just don't have time for that. When am I going to get it? Which reveals the entirely wrong kind of state of mind. Because it's based on getting something. When am I going to get it? How soon? How much work do I have to do to get it? Well, you're not going to get it until you stop trying to get something for yourself. And just devote yourself to this practice for its own sake, and in order to awaken for the sake of all sentient beings. I'm going to switch just momentarily to another text. This is Andy Ferguson's book, Zen's Chinese Heritage, where he puts in more accessible style of English what happened here. Oh, actually, this is the previous master, this Zhan Dong. Said, Zhan recognized Da Wei's unusual ability and assigned him to work as his personal attendant. But Da Wei's obstinate personality clashed with his teacher, leading to an exchange in which Zhan ridiculed the young student, saying, you haven't experienced enlightenment, and the problem is your intellectual understanding. So we went through that already, those exchanges back and forth. Now we're back to Yuan Wu, his second master. It says that when Dawi got to Yuanwu, he was asking for his teaching all day long. Yuanwu brought up Yunmen's saying, "East Mountain walks on the water," and assigned it to Dawi as his koan. Dawi came to him 49 times with presenting his understanding, but Yuanwu rejected all of them. One day, Yuanwu took his seat to give Taisho, and he quoted Yunmen. This is what Yunmen had said centuries earlier. "I am not this way. If someone asks, 'What is the place where all the Buddhas appear?' I just say to them, 'From the south comes a fragrant wind, producing a slight chill in the recesses of the palace.'" And now Dawi, hearing Yuanwu quote Yunmen, says he emptied out and thought he was enlightened. This is where it gets confusing. Emptied out, okay, maybe it just means he suddenly found himself in a samadhi condition, his mind free of thoughts. And the translator says he thought he was enlightened. It continues, Yuanwu investigated and found that although Dawi had managed to get before and after cutoff, in other words, his beyond extraneous thoughts, he's a state of samadhi, so the aspect of motion does not arise, still he was settling down in purity and nakedness. By that we can understand that he was still attached to this state of emptiness that he had stumbled into. This is a real challenge in practice, and more than a few people here have had to pass that test of suddenly finding the mind empty in a state of deep silence, and then realizing having to move beyond it. It's not our aim in Zen is just to try to cling to a quiet mind, silence. Our aim, in as much as there is an aim, is to awaken to our true nature. So then Dawi said, Yuanwu says to Dawi, "It wasn't easy for you to get to this stage. Too bad that having died, you are unable to come back to life." Without a doubt, words and phrases are a great disease. But haven't you seen the saying, and then he quotes, "Hanging from a cliff, let go, and agree to accept the experience. After annihilation, come back to life. I couldn't deceive you." Or, "Don't worry about dying, because you will come back to life. Trust me," he's saying. And then he went on to say, this is still Yuanwu talking to Dawi, "You must be aware that this truth exists." Dawi said, "Just based on today's attainment, I'm already joyous and lively. I can't understand anymore." So it's unclear here what Yuanwu would tell us about Dawi's experience, whether it was just a profound samadhi state he got into, which itself can be absolutely life-transforming in the sense that it reveals this realm that is beyond form, this realm of formlessness, emptiness, whether it's just that or whether there was some awakening he had. when he says here, when they have, when the translator has Dawi saying, I can't understand anymore. Does that mean there's no further I can go? My understanding is complete? Or does it mean I'm with no thought in the mind, there's nothing that I can understand in the ordinary sense. I'm beyond intellectualism. Anyway, Yuan Wu directed Da Wei to spend time with, here it says, gentlemen of affairs who came calling. So, apparently, this was at this monastery of Yuan Wu's, there were laymen who came, who visited, probably some distinguished laymen, because Yuan Wu himself was a famous teacher. We know that in other texts we read of high government officials who visited the temples and monasteries. Apparently, Yuan Wu felt that Da Wei needed to engage more with people of the world, people other than monks. And maybe this was one of the a prescription of Yuan Wu, a prescription to help Da Wei snap out of his attachment to emptiness and have to deal with the challenging art of social relations which demand discrimination. Zen has no quarrel with discrimination. Sometimes people can get the wrong idea about that. Discrimination means knowing the difference between a hot stove and a cold stove. We need to use our discriminating minds a lot. But it's different to discriminate when we've seen the other half of reality, that is, the realm of non-discrimination, of formlessness, non-differentiation. Once we've experienced that realm, then the world of discriminations, of right and wrong and high and low and the whole matter of timing. Timing is everything in a way. Then that is understood in its real essence, that it is essentially non-differentiated. And it says, whenever Da Wei went to Doksan, Yuan Wu brought up the same saying every time. And this is the saying, words or wordlessness, both are like vines wound around a tree. And he would ask Da Wei, how do you understand that? And as soon as Da Wei would start to say something, Yuan Wu would say, wrong, that's not it. And finally Da Wei said, this truth is like a dog looking at a pan of hot oil, wanting to taste it but unable to, wanting to give it up but unable to. To which Yuan Wu said, you've described it very well. This is the unbreakable trap, the thicket of thorns. By the way, people who have read The Three Pillars of Zen, and I hope everyone has read it, it's an absolutely unsurpassed text, book of in English of Zen, we may remember that this is an analogy simile that Yasutani Roshi offers. I think it's Yasutani Roshi. One of the masters in the Three Pillars says, like looking at a pan of hot oil, wanting to taste but unable to. Actually, I think it Roshi Kaplo himself uses it in his account of his story of his practice and his awakening. And then I'm going to switch back to Andy Ferguson's translation, which is less literal. It's a little easier to process. After 6 months had passed, and now Dawi was still working on this phrase, words and wordlessness both are like vines wound around a tree. And now Dawi is getting desperate, and he said to Wanyu, I've heard that previously you questioned Wu Zhu about this phrase. That's another famous master. But Dawi says, but I don't know what he answered. So he's desperate enough to say, what did that guy say? You asked him. Tell me, what did he say? Yuan Wu laughed. He saw what he was up to and didn't reply to Dawi's question. And then Dawi pressed him. He pushed back. He said, at that time, you posed this question to everyone. Why not say it again now? And then Yuan Wu said, I said to Wu Zhu, what is the meaning of the phrase, words and wordlessness? It is like a vine wound around a tree. Wu Zhu answered me by saying, you can't trace it, it can't be drawn. I then asked him, when the tree has fallen down and the vine has withered, what then? And then, this is still Yuan Wu, now quoting Wu Zhu, see what comes next. And at these words, Dawi was enlightened. He said, I understand. So this phrase, words and wordlessness, it is like a vine wound around a tree. It doesn't give away too much for me to just clarify that he's really saying what's beyond both with words and no words. If you're attached to neither words nor to silence, what then? What then? At that point, after Dawi's enlightenment, and he said, "When him he said, I understand." Yuan Wu questioned him with some difficult koans, and we're told Dawi replied to them all without getting stuck. And then Yuan Wu said, approvingly, he said, "At last, you know, I haven't been deceiving you." And then Yuan Wu accepted him as his Dharma heir, and the heir of the Lin Shi school. Then it says, after his great penetration, Dawi went back to several Chan masters. He had doubts about and asked Yuan Wu about them. Yuan Wu said, my Chan here is like a great ocean. To get it right, you have to take a great ocean and pour it in. If you just take a bowl, fill it with a little, and stop there, it's that your capacity is only that much. What would you have me do about it? Only a few can reach your level. There was one equal to you, but he has already died. And then soon after that, Yuan Wu began sharing, having Dawi share the teaching duties with him. And Dawi quickly became widely respected throughout the Chan monasteries. He came to the notice of a high minister and was given a purple robe. This was the greatest honor in ancient China. He's given a purple robe and the name Buddha Sun as a sign of imperial honor. Sun is S-U-N. And he was only at this, he was only 37 when he received this great honor. And then the biography here gets into all of the political storms, and he had to flee. Dawi had to flee to another province, and he so did Yuan Wu. They went together to another place. I'm going to just sort of skim over this. And then the political climate changed again. This is an old story in China where the winds will shift this way and that. Not just the masters, but all kinds of people who had been received, who had attained a state of great stature, government officials and all, would have to go into exile, and then things would change and they'd come back in and be recognized again, and then sometimes they'd have to disappear again when the winds shifted again. He got to the point where he had a huge monastery that where there were more than 1,700 monks. He's become very famous now. And then the repercussions of political struggle reached him, and he ran afoul of the prime minister. He was stripped of his imperial honors and certification, ordered to a malarial area in some godforsaken place in China. Even there, they say, in one summer, he is said to have produced 13 enlightened people. And then he was exonerated. And at the age of 68, after 15 years away, he returned to the capital, and then he was he retired. Allah, he was relieved of his temple duties, retired. Then, when he was 75 years old, he fell ill. And he told his huge congregation, "Tomorrow, I'm going." And in the pre-dawn hours, after he'd written his last bequest and a letter to the emperor, the monk, one of the monks who was attending on him, asked him for a verse. This was standard operating procedure in those days, is to leave a final verse. And then in a mock serious voice, Dawi said, "Without a verse, I couldn't die." And then he agreed. He took up the brush, dipped it in the ink, and this is what he wrote. Very famous final words. "Birth is thus, death is thus. Verse or no verse, what's the fuss?" And with that, he died. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.